I'm Georgie Crawford. You're listening to the Good Glow podcast. Throughout my treatment for breast cancer, I've realised the importance of self-care. Whether it's a trip to the gym, a checkup with your GP, or even a 5-minute pamper session, the time has come for us to put ourselves higher on our own to-do list. I'll speak to people who remind us to take better care of ourselves and people who will motivate us and inspire positive change. This podcast is made possible by Sally Hansen, the creator of which was an inspirational woman who promoted the message of self-care all the way back in the 1930s. Whether it's a quick tan application or a cuticle oil top-up, Sally Hansen wants us to have the power to feel like our best selves. This week on The Good Glow, I talk to Sinead Hingston. Sinead's story is one of overcoming. Sinead lost her husband when she was just 30 years old and 19 weeks pregnant. While in Portugal on a family holiday and out on a boat trip, she watched Jeff lose his life suddenly after jumping into the water. As Jeff was raced to shore on a dinghy, Sinead was forced to stay on the boat for an agonising 2 hours with no news on how he was. When they were eventually brought to shore, Sinead's worst nightmare was confirmed. She speaks about how human connection and support helped her get through a time of pure heartbreak and devastation, and how she put one foot in front of the other until she finally found happiness again. And I, for one, am in absolute awe of her. Sinead, thank you so much for joining me on the Good Glow podcast. I'm thrilled that we finally get to sit down together. You've been an amazing support to me over the last couple of years. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Very honoured to be here.
You have an unbelievable story, and I feel blessed that you have chosen to tell it on my podcast, and thank you for that. I want to go right back to the start when you met Jeff, what your relationship was like, and just tell us how mad about him you were.
Okay, well, I met Jeff one night. I was babysitting for his sister and her children, and I arrived at his sister's house in a pair of tracksuit bottoms and a hoodie and greasy hair. And I knocked on the door and expecting Jill or one of the girls to answer. And this guy answers the door and I'm like, oh my God, who are you? Absolutely mortified, went bright pink. And he was like, oh, hi, I'm Jeff, I'm Jill's brother. And I was like, okay. So went straight in, sat with the girls, was messing around with them. And he came in and sat down and we were doing that brain game that was on the Nintendo, I think it was the DS. So like literally about 45 minutes later, Jill came down and she said, you know, are you coming out with us, Jeff, or are you staying here with Sinead? And he went beetroot. He was mortified. He was like, no, I'm coming out. So the reason I was babysitting was because he was over from the UK for the weekend and they were all heading out for a few drinks. So he arrived home much earlier than the others that night. And we sat again for another couple of hours just chatting about life and, you know, random things. He was 7 years older than me, so his experiences were obviously to me so much more than mine. He lived in the UK, he worked for Sky Sports, he just had this colourful, you know, story. But I just, it's just the tingles. I can't even
love it for sight.
I can't even explain it. Like, oh God, yeah, yeah. So I left that night and, you know, I had said, I had texted Jill when they were on their way into town saying, like, you should, she wanted to find him an Irish girlfriend so he'd move home. That was her ultimate goal, was to bring him into town. And I had texted her and said, you'll have no problem finding him an Irish girl. Like, you know, have a great night. And she told him. So he knew that I had a little bit of, you know, interest. So from there, we kind of, we were texting through Jill, but we didn't have each other's numbers. So like he would text me and Jill would send it on and I would reply to Jill and she'd send it back to him.
Wow.
This went on for a while. And then we finally got each other's number and the first text he ever sent me was a direct line, this could be interesting. And yeah, we moved in together after 12 weeks. He moved home to Ireland then for a year. It was 2008, so it was recession, not great. He moved home then for a year. We moved in together 12 weeks after we kind of got together. So it was just...
So it was obviously love at first sight
too.
Did you speak to him about what he thought of you when you first met?
I think he pretty much said to his best mate as well. I had said to my best friend, Carrie, like, I'm going to marry this guy. And she was like, well, I need to meet him first before we go that far. But yeah, we'll see. And as far as I know, he had pretty much said the same thing to his best mate, that, you know, this was the girl he was going to marry. It was just instant attraction.
The way it was supposed to be.
Yeah, yeah.
And tell us about your engagement.
So I, after a year of living in Ireland, things that he couldn't really get much work. He was doing a bit of work for RT Sports. And it was hard. He was freelance, so it was hard to get work at the time. So we ended up moving back to the UK, or he moved back and I went with him. So I took a career break, moved back to the UK and moved over in the July. And I found it really hard. Like, the UK to me was, I'd never lived away from home, so it was huge. And that December, so we were only there since July, that December he arrived home from work one evening. I was lying on the couch feeling sorry for myself, and he arrived in with this photo book and he said, right, you can open the first couple of pages. And he was like, hey baby, I've just arrived in from work and you're lying on the couch on your laptop. I was like, so predictable. And then as the pages turned, I was only let go a certain way, and he said, you need to go upstairs and pack a bag, and these are the kind of clothes you need. Like, there was photos of us in ski gear. So I was like, my God, we're going skiing, like, amazing. So he said, the car will be here at 5 a.m. So the next morning, got up. I was off sick anyway, weirdly enough. I had really, really bad cold. Car arrived at 5, off to Heathrow, and the next page was, so we're off to Lapland. And I was like,
oh my God,
to see Santa. I was like, amazing. So we went to Lapland and stayed in the Ice Hotel, which was just magical. So the first day we got there, had the tour of the hotel, and then we went out in a one-horse open sleigh ride. And halfway through the jingles of the sleigh rides with stars galore above our heads, he got out and he was like, oh, you know, get out and come for a walk. And I was like, I'm not getting out. It was like minus 30 degrees. So eventually he got me out and, yeah, dropped down to one knee, shaking so badly he nearly dropped the ring in the snow because it was so cold. But yeah, it was amazing. Like, it was.
And what was that night like?
It was just magical. Like, looking back now, it just feels like this distant dream that kind of I saw in a movie, but it wasn't actually my life, if you know what I mean. So, yeah, we got back to the hotel and phoned mum and dad, and they were just, everybody was just over the moon. Like, it was just a perfect relationship. Like, we never really argued. We kind of, if we disagreed, we just sat down, we talked things through. There was never really any annoyances but we were really lucky and we just met. So we were still in that kind of lovey honeymoon phase of life. We had no children, we had no house, we had no mortgage, you know, we had nothing to worry about as such. So then the wedding plan started. So we got married then a year later in Dundrum Church.
The year of the snow, 2010, was
yeah,
it?
Yeah. So we we met at Christmas, we got engaged at Christmas, we got married at Christmas. So yeah, the 27th of December. So it was the year of the really bad snow. So we had all of our pre-wedding stuff was all cancelled because everybody was snowed in. So.
And was that stressful? Like,
it was. And by the day the wedding came around, I was like, do you know what? I don't care if I have to walk to the church at this stage. I just want to get married. I just want to marry him. And it was quite stressful because, you know, you didn't have your rehearsal, whatever, and you were kind of going in blind to like this big, huge day. But it was amazing. Like, the people we had there, and I mean, you know, three of them already aren't with us anymore. And just to have that big day and the video of it and the pictures is just really special now. Like, and when you look back, it's kind of, yeah, it does. It feels like a distant memory sometimes.
It's one of those things that you just have to enjoy the good times when they're
absolutely
happening.
So we had gone to the Maldives on our honeymoon just after the wedding. We landed actually on New Year's Eve. And sadly, only 7 days after that, his mother actually passed away suddenly. So we had to come home early. Sorry, we came home early from the Maldives. So she had passed away that January. So we kind of decided we were a bit silly. We went away to the Maldives and we only had European travel insurance. We never even thought to check. So we couldn't use insurance to get us home. We had to pay for everything ourselves to fly back again. So we decided we were just going to do kind of a cheap summer holiday. My parents had a lovely 5-bed villa that one of my father's friends had loaned to him for a couple of weeks, and they said, look, just pay for the flights and come over and stay with us for a couple of weeks.
And in the meantime, you'd found out that you were pregnant.
Yes. So it was actually the day of Jeff's mother's funeral that he decided to tell her that we were going to start trying for a baby. And I'm standing there going, all right, okay. Yeah, that's great. And we were so lucky. Like, that was January, and by March I was pregnant. Like, there was no, it just was so easy. Everything just worked the way it was kind of supposed to work, I suppose.
And can you remember the moment when you told him you were pregnant?
So I was in Tralee. He was working on an Arsenal match. So he was in the Emirates and they were in a basement. So that's where they do all the work from. So he had no reception for the day. And I had gone to Mass on Easter Sunday, and we had been walking in the Gap of Dunloe the day before, and I was obviously due my period, and I was like, you know, God, it still hasn't come, but I have that like pre-period pains in my tummy. I was like, it's really strange. So then it was Mom that said to me, you know, have you got that yet? And I was like, no, actually. So after Mass, I went off to the chemist and just said, maybe, just maybe. So I went up to the bathroom after Mass, and lo and behold, 2 to 3 weeks on the little clear blue test, and I just was... like, it was so bizarre, because I'm standing in my aunt's toilet in Tralee, nobody around me, and I'm like, I'm not going to see him now for another, it was another week, I think, after that, before I was going back. I obviously did the calculations, and I was due on Christmas Eve, which just made me laugh, because my family were just like, right, that's it, no more anything around Christmas time, because you've had enough attention around Christmas. And when I added the dates in, it was just like, oh my goodness, I'm due on the 24th, they're going to kill me. I literally sent him a little email saying, looks like we're gonna ruin another family Christmas. So June the 20th, he was 37. So he kind of, part of him had settled on the fact that he was never really going to have a family, even if he did meet somebody that he might be too old to have kids, or, you know, he just never really thought that he'd be lucky enough to have them. But
so you went back to London then with this amazing news.
Yeah, ran like into where you come out of the airport and like pick me up and swung me around, and it was amazing. But it was just such a nice, happy feeling after all of the sadness, obviously, of his mum passing away. And, you know, it was just like, okay, the cloud is lifting, you know, we can look forward now, and, you know, this is really special, and hopefully it's a little girl and we can name her, you know, partly after his mom. And it was just really special. We decided then in July. He literally had worked so hard up until then, and the Champions League was on, and the, you know, Premiership was on. So he had very little time off, and we just said, right, we're going to go away and have a really nice holiday in Portugal.
So he, at the time, he was Jeff the Ref on Soccer AM. People may remember him. I used to watch it back in the day. It was such a good show. So his career was thriving.
Was it stressful
for him, or was he able to enjoy work?
He loved what he did. He was really meticulous, and he was a producer for Sky Sports. So he worked freelance, so he wasn't directly employed by Sky. But yeah, I mean, like, he loved working. He worked so hard, but, you know, it was a very well-paid job. He was rewarded for the work he put in. But yeah, I mean, there was weeks that he went without one day off, that he had some, you know, something to do and work. So in that regard, it was quite stressful that he was working so much. So Portugal was like this welcome kind of breakaway, and it was like, right, leave the phone off during the day and we'll just go to the pool and we'll read books, and then in the evening if you need to pick up something, that's fine, but let's have our time together. So I had suggested to Mum and Dad that we ask his dad to come with us, because he had nobody to go away with that summer.
That's so thoughtful.
Yeah, I just, you know, I said it to Jeff, and Emerald and Ken went away every summer together, and I was like, you know, why don't we see, there's plenty of rooms in this villa we're staying in. It was stunning. Yeah, so, you know, Ken was like, oh, I'd love to come. So he came over with us. We met him in Faro the day we landed. It was pretty much the same time. So the idea was that we'd stay with all of the parents for a week, and then we would stay for a week on our own when they all left, just to have kind of real quality time together.
And what was that week like?
It was lovely. It was full on. We did a lot of stuff. You know, we went out to dinner every evening, but we were in and out of Villamora, and we were doing bits and pieces, and, you know, there was sand castle display things on, and we made sure we kept kind of busy enough and did lots of family stuff. I ended up in the dentist, and it was just one of those mad weeks that you're kind of like, you know, this week now with nobody here is going to be amazing, because it's been a bit mad. So the Sunday then that Mum and Dad and Ken were due to go home, we decided to go out on that boat trip the morning of, just to kind of have one last thing to do before.
Family kind of occasion.
Yeah.
So you went out onto the boat.
Yeah. So we had booked this kind of, it's just a trip that you go in and out of the caves along the Algarve coast, which are obviously stunning. And we left in the morning. It was quite hot, and the boat that we had originally wanted to book was a covered boat, but the morning of it, something got messed up or mixed up, and we ended up on a half covered and half not covered boat. So myself and Mum ended up sitting kind of on the top deck in the sun, and Ken and Jeff were down the back in the covered part. So yeah, we took off, and just as we were leaving, the captain was like, "Is there anyone here pregnant?" And I'm like, "Well, yeah, I'm pregnant. Oh, the last pregnant person I had on this boat, we ended up in hospital because she went into labour." I was like, okay.
Thanks, yeah. Captain.
Thank you for that. And I said, "Oh, I'm only 9 weeks and, you know, I've been on boats loads. I'll be fine." Or 19 weeks, sorry, 19 weeks. Been on loads of boats, I'll be fine. And literally within a half an hour, I started to feel really sick. So panic attacks, the hands went all tingly and white spots. And I was just like, I don't feel well at all. But we were already way out. So I ended up going down to the bottom of the boat because that's apparently where you don't feel much at all. Mm-hmm. And I lay on the couch. So there's loads of pictures of me on our lovely new camera that we had bought each other a couple of weeks before, of me lying on this sofa, on this couch, on this boat. But yeah, I didn't feel well at all. I felt really panicky, really, really sick, you know, really dodgy stomach. So hogging the toilet, God love everybody else on the boat. But yeah, I wasn't well at all. And then the boat stopped and the first 16 people got on this massive dinghy to go into the caves. So there was kind of, I think there was going to be maybe two or three runs in and out of the caves of people. So there was, I couldn't tell you how many people on the boat, but there was maybe 50, I'd say. So the first lot of people went in and the captain just said, "Look, anyone who wants to go in for a swim, you're more than welcome to jump in while we're waiting." And Jeff was such a water baby, absolutely loved the water. And he initially wasn't going to go in because he was like, "Well, I'm dry. And if I jump in now, I'm going to be wet sitting on the dinghy." Mm-hmm. I had decided at that point that I wasn't going anywhere near this dinghy because I just wasn't feeling well at all. And I know now it was a massive panic attack and I just, very odd. But at this stage, I was sitting back up the top because the boat had stopped. And he kind of said, "Right, you know what, I'm going to jump in." Like, I was like, "You know, you'll regret it if you don't go for a swim. Like, it's so beautiful and picturesque. Mm-hmm. Like, just do it." So there was a couple of dads and a couple of daughters had already jumped in. So then he kind of stripped off and there was this bizarre chill of cold air. So there's one picture of me and I have a blanket around me. And like, you're in Portugal in July, it's so, so hot. But just all of a sudden, this cold, cold breeze came. And Jeff was like, "Oh, it's a bit colder than I thought." And I was like, "But it was fine 2 minutes ago." Like, so he jumped in, feet first. So jumped in and I was snapping away with the camera. And this camera takes like 8 photos a second. And it's like this, you know, lovely Canon camera. So I'm clicking away and he's smiling and he's holding his hands up with the sun behind him and swimming around absolutely fine. And then one of the little girls in the water had grabbed onto her dad and kind of pushed him under the water. So he was roaring at her. And myself and mom, being women, were like, "Oh God, that was so dangerous. You know, did you see what she did? He got an awful fright." So there's about 40 seconds of a gap in the pictures that I was taking. And then I picked the camera back up and I started snapping away at Jeff again. And that's when I realised that there was something wrong, that he wasn't okay. So he had been swimming up and down fine. And then when I looked over again, I kind of took a few more, I kind of hit the button on the camera and took loads of pictures and I was like, "Oh God, he actually doesn't look okay."
Like in what way?
He was on his back, staring at the sky and his left hand was flicking like really quickly, like a kind of fish out of water almost. It's the only way that I've ever been able to describe it. And his eyes were wide open. He was staring just straight up and his mouth was wide open. So it looked like he was gasping for air. It looked like his throat was just closing up on him. So I kind of started calling, and I wouldn't be a squealer or a screamer, like I'm quite a deep, deep voiced girl. So I was kind of going, Jeff, are you okay? And he used to always lie back in the pool and just float.
Mm.
And part of me was like, that's all he's doing, but he should be answering me.
Yeah, but you were getting a little bit nervous at this point.
Absolutely, yeah. So I then started shouting properly at him and there was no response at all. So then Mom and Ken were shouting and there was nothing. And then he went limp. So his legs went down and his face went into the water. So I started screaming at the two men that were already there. And another younger guy had jumped in the meantime swimming. So I was shouting at him. Like, the boat was quite big. So it wasn't just a boat you could jump off safely. Like, it was quite a big boat. But yeah, so I tried to get the guys in the water to go over and at least pull him up out of the water. But he was kind of looking at me going, "Huh?" So he swam over and he kind of poked him. And I was like, no, lift his face up. He's drowning. Like, lift his face up out of the water. So in that moment, the dinghy, it just went mad. The dinghy is then coming back out of the caves at this moment, just by pure chance. So the dinghy's coming out. I'm roaring at the captain, like going, "My husband's drowning. Like, you need to get him out of the water. Like, please get him out of the water." And he's kind of, I don't know. He was just like, "Huh? What is the problem?" I was like, "My husband, there's something wrong with my husband." So he eventually jumped in, which it felt like about 15 minutes after, mm-hmm. but it wasn't. It was obviously all within seconds. So they dragged Jeff up onto the dinghy rather than the main boat. They would never have gotten him back up onto the main boat. And all I can think of now, even still, is those poor 16 people on that dinghy that were sitting around while he was like laid out in the middle of it. And there was two men, from what I've heard since, working on him the whole way back. They literally went from there. They wouldn't let me on the dinghy. I tried to scramble to get onto it with them, and they were like, we don't have time, and they left. And I was like...
And you were just left on the boat.
So I didn't know if he was okay or not. I was like when they pulled him out of the water, there was a little bit of foam coming out the corner of his mouth, and I was like, God, what the hell was that? Like, but he was lifeless. I mean, he was gone at that stage. Like, but in my head, I was like, oh, he's just passed out. Like, whatever's wrong with him, he's fine. He's after fainting or something in the water. So it was 2 hours, I think, and 20 minutes before they came back to get us, which was the most hellish.
What did you do on the boat for
that? I went mental. I'm not going to lie. I roared at the captain, like, not abusively, but like literally saying to him, like, you need to bring me back. I can't stay on this boat. You know, I could see another beach from where we were. And I was like, you know what? I'm actually just going to swim to that beach, and I'm going to get a taxi back to Albufeira. And, you know, this is ridiculous. You can't keep me on this boat. And he kept saying, you know, all of these people on this boat have paid for this trip, and we need to think of them. And I'm going,
are you serious?
Look around you. Everyone's crying. Everybody. And I was like, nobody wants to be here. Like, ask people. They will let you bring me back to the shore. But he was just so stubborn. It was like protocol that they couldn't take the anchor up and bring me back. Now, maybe he knew before I did. You know that way as well?
It's so hard, because when you're at that moment, like, you're desperate for people to help. Yeah. And it's like, when someone doesn't help, what can you do?
But nothing.
Just fall to pieces.
Oh, absolutely.
And what was your mum saying to you at this point?
Mum, we were frantically... So my dad hadn't come on the boat trip with us. He had stayed back in the villa. So we were frantically trying to call dad. But we knew that he was probably either at the pool or somewhere without his phone. So then I had to call my brother, I think it was my younger brother, and just say to him, look, we need you to get the number of these villas and try and get somebody from the main office to go call down to number whatever and get dad to answer his phone. We need dad to get to Albufeira because Jeff really isn't right. There's something wrong. And they were like, yeah, no worries. So this was all going on while we were frantically trying to get off this boat. So eventually we see the dinghy coming back with nobody on it but the driver of the dinghy, or whatever you call them, and a paramedic. And I was like, why is there an ambulance guy on the dinghy and no Jeff and no other people? So they put myself, Mom and Ken on the dinghy, nobody else. And we got back to, I felt like he just went so slow. And I was like, can you go a bit quicker? Like,
this is an emergency.
Yeah. So got back anyway. And when we got to Albufeira, it just felt like there was nobody bar this other ambulance person who came and met us on the like jetty thing that we got off. So the three of us got off the boat. I kind of ran up ahead of Mom and Ken and just was like, you know, what's going on? Where is he? And, oh, please just come with us. And I was like, all right, okay. So they sat me in an ambulance, and I'm kind of looking at it going, well, like, where is Jeff? Like, why isn't he here in this ambulance? Like, maybe he's fine. And I'm kind of going, maybe he's, you know,
gone off
to the toilet or something.
Yeah.
Like, so they sat me down on the little bed, and he kept asking me questions, and he was like, you know, did he hit his head when he jumped into the water? And I said, no. He said he jumped in feet first. Like, he was swimming around for ages before anything happened. Like, he was fine. And, you know, were you drinking this morning? And I was like, sorry? And he's like, well, you know, did you have alcohol during your breakfast? And I said, well, no. I said, it was 9 o'clock in the morning. Like, I'm pregnant, and we may be Irish, but like, we're not, you know, we're a couple on holidays with our parents. Like,
yeah.
And I said, no, he wasn't. And I'm kind of going, like, where is he? You know, stop with this rubbish. Like, so then he just kind of, he said, you know, your husband arrived in the dinghy. And I said, yeah. I said, look, you know, where is he? I really just want to go and sit with him. And he said, I'm really sorry. And I said, like, what? And he was like, we worked on him for a very long time. And I was like, okay, but where is he? Still expecting him to be fine. And he just said, I'm sorry, he didn't make it. And I just remember just going, what? And I kind of laughed at him. I was like, yeah, okay, no, seriously, where is my husband? Like, can we just stop this joke? Whatever this is, or whatever's going on, I just want to go and sit with him. And I know he's going to be fine, and everything's going to be fine. God, it gets me still. But yeah, so I just remember getting really kind of panicky and just being like, this can't actually be happening. And this kind of blackness came over me. So I could feel it from like the top of my head And I was like, I'm going to pass out. Like, I'm going to black out. I need to lie down. So I was already on a bed, but I just needed to get out of this tiny ambulance. So there was a side door on it. And I went to, I literally like pushed him out of the way and went to walk out. And I obviously blacked out then. And I actually fell head first out the side door of the ambulance. So when I came to, then I was lying on the bed, hooked up to a drip myself. And I also, when I you know, was blacking out, I just remember my mom just screaming like, no, 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 please, God, no. And I, like, it's one thing that's haunted me since, because I can't imagine anything like this ever happening to Lily, ever. Like, but yeah, so when I came to, I just said, look, I need to pee. It's like I had this overwhelming urge to go to the bathroom. And he just said, look, you know, there's no toilet. And I said, there has to be a toilet. So I said, there's a building, there's a big marina behind me. And he just said, look, if you go in there, you'll see him. And I was like, but I want to see him. I said, I want to sit with him. So I'm trying to pull the thing out of my arm. And I'm like, I just want to be with my husband. I just want to hold him. Like, I just need to sit with him. And he just said, look, how would you feel if you lost your husband and your baby in the same day? And I was like, I don't think that would be great, to be honest. So he said, look, we need to bring you to hospital and have you scanned and have the baby scanned and have you checked out. You know, you fell out of the ambulance. I did hit my head. I had like a graze in my forehead. And I was like, I'm fine. It was shock. And at this stage, I obviously had gone completely into shock. It was like, I was, you know, okay, this has happened. That's fine. Right. So I need to go to the bathroom. And, you know, everything came really. So yeah, he wouldn't let me go in, which again, it's one thing that I've had to kind of come to terms with and let go of. But they brought me then to Farrow Hospital.
And was your mum with you?
Yeah, so mum was with me. Dad had arrived in the meantime. So dad had taken Ken then, who was just completely in shock. I mean, there was no other way to describe it. We were all just like, what is happening? Like,
he lost his wife and now this.
His youngest, his baby, yeah. Yeah. So yeah, got scanned. Obviously the baby was fine. Like, Lily was only teeny weeny, as you can imagine. They're well protected. And the man that was doing the scan said, do you want to know what it is? And I was like, no, like, no,
this absolutely is not the time. Not.
Like, we were not going to find out. So no, this is not the day to find that out. So yeah, then I was sitting on kind of I had started to make phone calls on the way to the hospital in the ambulance. The ambulance siren's going off in the background and I'm sitting in the ambulance on the phone. Trying to call his sister, his brother, his best friend. All I could think of was, this is going to hit Facebook and I'm not going to have reached all of the important people that I need to reach to tell them what's happened. So literally within an hour of being told that he had died, I was on the phone trying to call people to let them know. And very much when I think back, like, how quick those phone calls must have been, because I was like, right, I need to ring such and such now. Like, I'm really sorry, I have to go. Kind of practical mind of, I need to be the one to tell people. I can't let them find out any other way. And I mean, still, there were so many people that found out on Facebook that I just had no control over it. You know, once it hits social media, that's it. Like, as you know yourself, it just goes mad. So yeah, I spent the afternoon then on the phone trying to, number one, didn't know where he was, didn't know where they had taken him either.
Could you believe, like, those words were coming out of your mouth?
No, I couldn't say Jeff has died or Jeff died today, or I couldn't say the word died or was dead. So I kept saying Jeff's gone, and like, my best friend Sarah was like, where is he gone? I was like, he's gone, Sarah, he's gone. She was like, gone where? And like, she was saying to me now, like, she'd even say, like, I thought he had left you, I thought he had just gone, I've had enough, I'm out of here. But yeah, I just couldn't bring myself to say Jeff is dead. So it was this kind of roundabout way of me going, you know, he went for a swim and something happened to him in the water and he's gone. Like, but yeah, I mean, his best friend was probably the hardest phone call I've ever had to make, like, ever. But yeah, I just kind of spent the day making sure that I had got to all the people I needed to get to. And they had given me 10 milligrams of diazepam in the hospital because I was obviously in complete shock, you know, starting to feel really panicky again. And I kept saying to the doctor, like, what am I going to do? I have nothing. Like, what am I going to do? And she gave me 10 milligrams of diazepam. So from the afternoon, whenever, you can imagine when that kicked in, that was me. I don't remember the rest of that day. I do remember a doctor calling out that evening. I think I had passed out in the bathroom. I think they'd called a doctor again. But yeah, it was just the next few days became this joke of trying to find out where they had taken Jeff. It was 2 days of... So once you have travel insurance, they put you in touch with Funeral Services International and they take over. So everything goes through them. So the guy arrived out that evening. I signed, I don't know how many bits of paper, couldn't even tell you what it was that I was signing, but it was all to do with, you know, letting him have an autopsy and saying that he was who he was, even though I didn't even know where he was. So it wasn't until the Tuesday afternoon that I finally lost the plot with them. And I said, you can't do this anymore. You need to tell me where my husband is. I need to go and see him, because I still hadn't got real confirmation that he was dead. It was kind of like, this is some big mistake and he's in a hospital somewhere hooked up to oxygen or something, but he's fine. Like, I just needed to see him.
So in the meantime, his best friend had arrived over and some more family members.
Yeah. So my brother and sister arrived over. Matt, his best friend, and his brother and sister arrived over that evening.
So you went
and his,
to see...
And his sister-in-law as well arrived over. So they all kind of arrived to the villa, which again was really overwhelming, because we'd gone from this, like, it was only meant to be Jeff and I that evening, to having everybody else but him. So I was like, oh my God, what is going on? But I mean, God, it was amazing to have them there. Like, amazing. It was just, I can't imagine had it happened on the Monday and I would have been on my own, completely on my own. But yeah, so they all arrived over and we... Literally, we spent the entire 2 days on the phone just ringing people at home and ringing people here and trying to get through to whoever we needed to get through to. But we finally found out on the Tuesday that he'd been taken to Portimao. And I was told when we got there that we could sit with him for as long as we wanted and, you know, don't feel under any pressure. You can stay with him if you want. And I was like, amazing. I was like, I'm sleeping in this place. I don't care. I'm not leaving him. So all day Tuesday, we were like, when can we come? When can we come? We finally got to go at, must have been about 5 o'clock. So I got in the car. I drove everywhere because I was like, I need to focus on something. So I got in the car. You know, we all got in the cars, drove over to Portimao. And it's this kind of the back of the hospital. It's almost like a delivery entrance, this big, huge opening. And then this door. And I just remember going, okay, this is it. Like, this is either... The biggest joke that's ever happened is in this isn't true and it's not going to be him, or this is the moment that you're going to cop on that he's not here anymore. So yeah, I went in, they kind of, it's now, it must have been about 20 past five, and we were left sitting there for ages and I was like, come on, you know, I just want to go in now. And you're sitting outside where he is. And eventually went in and I just remember grabbing his best friend's hand and saying, right, I'm going to keep my eyes closed, because, you know, there was a couple of people that didn't want to see him. So I said, right, well, Matt and I will go in. So I grabbed his hand and said, I'm going to keep my eyes closed. And if it's him, just squeeze my hand. And he was like, right, okay.
So you still had that, like, hope in your heart.
Completely. Because I was like, this is a mistake. Like, this cannot be happening to me. Like, this doesn't happen to me. This happens in magazines that I read, but not me. So yeah, I walked in and I felt the squeeze and I was like, shit. Like,
was that was the heartbreak?
Yeah. So I opened my eyes and do you know what? He looked... so perfect and peaceful, and he just had one little tear, which I'll never forget, just on his cheek, and a little eyelash, which I still have in a tissue. But yeah, just,
oh my God,
he just looked perfect. Then become like, right, okay, you know, this is crap,
this is it.
But
this is my reality and there's nothing I can do.
I have to now honour him and give him the best possible send off I can think of. Sorry.
Oh my God.
They were like, oh, you know, we close at 6. And I said, like, you told me I could sit with him for as long as I wanted. And they were like, sorry, we close at 6. So they kind of kicked us all out then. And then the next day, they basically said that from there, you know, they kind of get him ready to send him home. And I said, no, I want to see him tomorrow. I want to see him on Thursday. I want to see him every day. You know, I will be here every day to sit with him. So the Wednesday then, he had been brought to a different funeral kind of director's place. So I got to sit with him much, much longer on the Wednesday. And I'd given them clothes and everything for him. So yeah, but it was bizarre. Like, you know, yes, he was gone, but I sat with him and I chatted to him and I...
Did you get to say your goodbyes?
Kind of, in a weird way, yeah. Like, I took a picture of his hand on my tummy because, like, we hadn't even got to that. Like, the night before he died was the first time that he had felt a tiny flutter because she was only 19 weeks. So, like, I was only starting to feel little kicks at that stage. Lay in the bed for about an hour and I was like, no, it's kicking. And he was like really concentrating and eventually he was like, oh, I think I felt something. I was like, amazing. And that was literally the night before he died. So we never got to the kind of excited about the pregnancy thing either. And we hadn't really told many people because we had had a really early scare and we just decided we were going to wait till 20 weeks until after Portugal before we told people, like, you know, extended that we were pregnant. So when people found out that Jeff died, they also found out that I was pregnant. And some of them were like, we didn't even know you were pregnant. And now there's double whammy of that. But yeah, so we got him home late on the Thursday night. One of my things was that he had to fly with Aer Lingus. Like, I was like, you can't put him on any other airline. So I
because Aer Lingus to you was like home, kind of?
It was home, and he didn't really like flying with other airlines. He, like, any time he went on any short haul things was always Aer Lingus, and I was like, it would be an insult to him now at this stage. And it was just, I have to say, it was amazing. Like, we got to Faro Airport. We were really well looked after in that regard, as in, like, once we got to the airport, because the Aer Lingus staff were there. So we didn't have to sit with, I was in a wheelchair. I couldn't even walk through the departures. I was just, I was done at that stage. And I knew what I was facing when I got home. Like, it was one thing sitting in Portugal and being able to hold his hand and, you know, be with him. But the second I got home, I knew that that was the end of all of that. So, yeah, arrived at the air, the, where you leave. And they put us in a separate little place on our own. You know, one of the air hostesses, she was actually Portuguese, came up and she was bawling and she was like, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. And you shouldn't be doing this, you're so young. And she said, my dad died a month ago and it's just horrible and I'm so sorry. And she was just hysterical. And I was like, thank you. Like, you know, just the people were actually going, this poor girl.
Yeah.
So then we ended up on a little minibus by ourselves and they brought us out to the plane before anybody else. But all of the crew were on the stairs in like a little guard of honour. Like, it was just so, like, it was a big gesture, but like it, a small gesture at the same time, but it just meant so much. It was myself, my mum, my sister, and my brother. Everybody else had gone home the night before just to kind of obviously get things ready at home. So yeah, we got on the flight. They were amazing. Wouldn't let us pay for anything. Like, I got on the plane and the first thing I said was like, is he on board? Like, I just need to know that he's on this plane. So the poor air hostess, like, she was crying as well. And she was like, you know, I'm sure he is, but I will check, obviously. So she came back and she was really upset. And she was like, yeah, he's actually right below you. So I was like, OK, good. You know, he's here with me. When we got home, then, we, you know, they were amazing. They met us off the plane. I was allowed to sit and wait to see him coming off. And then I walked through, but no security, no nothing. Like, it was amazing. And there were so many people there when we walked out of arrivals, like, so many.
So just people
friends
to support
and family
you.
Just standing there. Just to be there. Like,
it means so much.
Oh, it really did. Like, and I, when I think about it, I'm kind of going, God, would I have done that? Like, would you even think to do that? It was just amazing. There was about 50 or 60 people.
Isn't it funny, like, when you're in crisis and people do things for you and then you question if you would have done the same thing?
Like, it really has opened my eyes to so many little gestures that just mean so much and meant so much to me over the years. And I'm like, that's going to make me a better person, if anything. Like, I'm going to be nicer. I'm going to do little nice things for other people that are going through really shitty times.
And did that, did your baby in your stomach make you feel closer to him through all of this?
Like, I think at the time, I only had like a little food belly. I was like bloated, like I'd eaten a slice of toast. You know, I didn't feel very pregnant. I didn't have any morning sickness, nothing. So yeah, I as I got more pregnant, absolutely, I became very protective over my bump and over, like, I couldn't eat. I used to eat brioche. It was the only thing I could stomach. Everything else made me sick. So I remember sitting with the psychiatrist in Hottle Street, who is amazing. And if anybody is told that they should go and see him, like, don't be afraid. Go and sit down with him. Dr. McCarthy is an incredible person, but he really got me through those last few hard weeks of pregnancy without Jeff. I even had a panic attack sitting outside his office one day and he just came and sat beside me and he was like, you're fine, you're fine. You know, just an amazing human being. But I, yeah, I mean, just a protection thing. And then having the other thing of like, I can't eat, so this baby is going to suffer. Like, what if the baby dies as well? You know, I'm killing it by not being able to eat. And he was like, you know, this is a weird way to look at it, but this baby is a parasite and it will feed off you, your everything, and it will be fine. It'll be you that'll get sick, not the baby. The baby's going to be fine. And I was like, all right, okay, that's a really weird way to look at it, but okay, there's this alien growing in my stomach, but that's fine. So yeah, it then absolutely became my focus, getting a nursery, like, moved back to mum and dad. So we had to go and pack up our house in London 2 weeks after the funeral.
So there was absolutely no question of you staying in London then?
Well, we were only renting and, like, I couldn't afford it to live there by myself. Like, we were only renting over there. So we packed up, went over with mum and met loads of his amazing friends who are still very close friends of mine now. So packed up the house, put it into a truck and moved it over here and put it into storage. So it was just like, right, that's that part of my life. I've now packed it all up into boxes, putting it in storage, and I am rewinding 4 years and moving back in with mum and dad with, you know, only your bare belongings, obviously, because you're living in your parents' house. It was just, it was bizarre. And yeah, and Kobe as well, like our husky, had to move back in as well. So it was just, yeah.
It's devastating.
Really awful. Yeah, yeah. But yeah, so we got him home on the Thursday, and he was buried then on the Saturday. The Friday, all of his colleagues from Sky arrived over, so there was a lot of people at his funeral. There was people spilling out of Dundrum Church.
Did that mean a lot to you?
My friend took photos at the funeral, and she only gave them to me a couple of months after, and she was like, I know you're going to appreciate these because you love photography so much. And she was like, I didn't want to give them to you straight away because obviously it would have been too much, but they are the most beautiful things to have because I don't remember much of it. I remember going to pass out and having to be carried to the toilet in the middle of the mass. I remember Pete Fagan, who had been our wedding, the guy who sang the wedding, he did the music for the funeral, and like they brought him out to You Raise Me Up, and I'll just never forget it. It was just the most amazing song that I could have picked for leaving the church. So there's parts of it that I kind of remember, but you know, the graveyard, everything, I don't remember at all. So it's nice to have the pictures and to see the faces that I didn't see that day. Like, I had locked myself in the car straight after the mass. I didn't want to talk to anybody, didn't want to see anybody. So I was very much felt like a bit of a, I don't know, prim and proper, but I was like, I can't talk to anybody else.
And how old were you here at this point?
I was 30. I just turned 30 that April.
So young.
Yeah, so we'd gone to Philly's then after for the afters, the good old Philly's when it was open. And that was lovely. Like, it was nice to be surrounded by so many people at that stage. But a lot of people, like, you know, the things you say to people, you just, it's funny, people saying, you know, rubbing my tummy, who I'd never met before, like rubbing my tummy going, but you know, you're going to be fine. You've got a little bit of him in there, you know, a little bit of him will live on. And I'm like, this is not going to replace my husband. Like, it's wonderful that I'm pregnant, but it was just, it's funny looking back, the things that people think that will
help
comfort you, and you're going, no. But that's when I became, after the funeral, I was like, nobody else is touching this bump until I have this baby, or never again, obviously, because it was just, it was like people kind of went, oh, you know, we'll give her Bubba Rump and we'll get a little feel of Jeff. Like, it was the most bizarre thing in the world. My dress was actually dirty when I took it the following day. I was like, oh my God, there was rub marks on my stomach.
Oh my God.
Yeah. It was just really overwhelming. Like, but yeah, so Lily arrived then.
On the 11th
of
December.
On the 11th of December. Nice and early, thank goodness.
And who was with you when she was born?
So my mum and my sister, they were on holiday with me. So my waters broke at home. I actually thought she had kicked me up in my ribcage somewhere. It was actually my waters popping. Maybe she did kick them. I don't know. So yeah, I just remember like walking really slowly up to mum and dad's room and whispering in the door going, Mom, I think my waters have broken. And then I'm like, why am I whispering? This is huge. Like, I'm about to have this baby. And randomly, my sister lives in Belfast, but was just so happened to be down that weekend. So Kira drove into Holles Street like a bat out of hell. And I was like, OK, I think you can slow down. I think we're going to be fine. And got in there. And yeah, that was not the nicest experience. That it's another story for another day. I had a pretty horrific delivery, so none of it was easy at all. But yeah, she arrived safe, which was absolutely the ultimate main thing. Can't say much for me after it, but yeah, she was 5'7", teeny tiny.
Wow. And did you have the name Lily picked out?
So Jeff and I had decided we were going to call her Lily Emerald, which was Jeff's mother's name. If we had a girl, we didn't know what we were having, and we hadn't decided on boys' names, but we just knew I loved the name Lily. I used to coach kids play ball when I was in the UK, and I just loved all my Lilies in my class. They were just all so lovely. So I was like, we're definitely, if we have a girl, we're going to call her Lily. And Lily Emerald had a lovely ring to it. So it was like, yeah. And we were still debating and crossing out the names in the boys' book. And yeah, so when I had her then, I just decided, like, I'm actually going to call her Lily Jeff. So she's Lily Jeff now.
Is she?
Yeah.
That's
and she's
beautiful.
Like Lily Ref to all of his friends because of Jeff the Ref. So nice.
Oh, wow. That is absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, she's Lily Jeff. So I was like, you're going to actually christen her that? I was like, yeah. Yeah, I am.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's cool.
What's she like?
She's as fiery as I am. So she definitely has my, yeah, my personality in a lot of ways, but she's just so like her dad. Like she's the spit. She probably, as she's got older, she probably looks a bit less like him. She's kind of come into herself, but when she was younger, she was just a mini, mini me of Jeff. It was like scary. You turn around and go, whoa, you know, there's Jeff. She'd have these faces that she'd pull or little comments that she'd come out with and like, oh my goodness, there's your dad.
And when she was born, like when the midwife handed Lily to you, what were you feeling then?
I was devastated. I think I really missed out on the exhilarating happiness that you should feel. And I know a lot of women don't feel it, but like more often than not, you get to hold your newborn baby and they're crying in your arms and it's meant to be the most amazing experience. But I was devastated and it was a new sense of, oh my God, like I am now responsible for this tiny human. Like it is up to me and Mia. And Jeff was very sensible and very clever. And, you know, I was like, I don't have that sensible person anymore. Like I've got to do this by myself. Like, no more joking around, no more anything. This is all on me. So when I was in labour, I had brought in a picture of him and stuck it on the wall in front of me. So this was my focus to get the baby out.
And did you imagine like what he would have been saying to you at the time?
Yeah. And like my sister and my mum were amazing. Like they were absolutely, Kira was proper midwife, like, you know, down there and, you know, really getting stuck in. Mum was up here at my ear going, you know, doing everything with me. And they were great crack. Like they put on the masks and they were, you know, taking pretend Charlie's Angels pictures. And they were really trying to keep the spirits up in the room because it was really, really difficult. And then things started going a bit pear-shaped. So it got a bit panicky. And then they handed her to me eventually. And I just asked them for the picture of him. And I just, like, there's a picture. Kira took a picture of me with Lily on my chest and me holding up the picture of Jeff with his T-shirt just draped over my shoulders so she could, my God, 19 weeks after he died, there was no smell of Jeff left on the T-shirt. But in my head, I'm going like, this is a bit of your dad here on my shoulder. And I'm holding up the photo and you can just see the devastation on my face. Like, it's not a happy, here's my gorgeous baby. It's a, this is your daddy and you're never going to get to meet him. Which is...
How did you feel about... talking about Jeff, like as you were going through the grieving process, did you want to keep talking about him? Did you like when people brought him
Absolutely.
Up?
I think it's a huge thing in Ireland that we kind of tend to forget, silently kind of forget about people who have passed away. And I think it's something that we really need to change. Like, I feel really sad when people don't talk about him and when they don't mention him. And
do you think that people are afraid? Like, some
totally
are
afraid. They're afraid they're going to upset me. And it's completely the opposite.
The
I'm
opposite.
Like, no, tell me a story about him. You know, bring him up in a conversation. Don't you remember when Jeff did that? Like, just because he's gone doesn't mean you're ever going to stop thinking about him. And, like, I have a couple of pictures in the house of him because it's so important for me and for Lily to know that she does have a father and he was a huge part of my world and my life and her life. And, you know, I just think it is so... And Lily and I talk about him quite a bit, you know, in a just a nice kind of like, oh, well, you know, I might come out with, oh, you sound like your dad, you know.
And she probably loves that.
Oh, she loves it. Like, does he make this face, mommy? And she'll pull a face and, you know, like she sees pictures of him all the time. So she knows that she does, like her jawbone is quite like his and around her eyes is quite like him. And she does love it. And she feels really lucky because now she has two daddies and she's got one up on other people. You know, it's since then, obviously, I've met somebody else and it's wonderful and they have become Lily's dad. And, you know, she's a very lucky girl in that sense. But I'll never let her ever not know about Jeff or not kind of talk about Jeff because it's huge. Like, he's such a big part of our world.
And then in 2016, you decided to share your story.
Yeah.
It was Mental Health Awareness Week and you wrote a post on Facebook.
So I lay in bed one night and I kind of said to Michael, he was living in the UK and I'd phoned him and I said, look, you know, Mental Health Awareness Week, I think I've done pretty well. You know, I was still living at home and stuff, but I was back to work and life was kind of life and it was good again. You know, I started feeling good again and I just said to him, how would you feel if I told my story? And he was like, go for it. Like, people need to hear that you were so young and you really could have just given up and you didn't. Like, so I wrote the Facebook post and just had like Mental Health Awareness Week at the bottom or whatever the hashtag, I think it was I Am A Reason was the hashtag at the time. And it just went mad. Like, it was shared, you know, a couple of hundred times, but like so many likes. And then the journal had sent me a message saying, could we share it? And I said, yeah, absolutely. And then yeah, it ended up in Finland and the States, and they translated into languages, and it was just lovely to kind of go, you know what, it actually did mean something to people. And the amount of messages that I got from strangers saying, you are the reason that I got out of bed this morning after reading that.
So was your message like, don't give up message?
Absolutely. Like, you know, I hit the absolute rock bottom of my life the day that Jeff died and the weeks after it, and knowing, you know, that this is it. I'm 30 years old. I had everything going for me and now I have nothing.
Did you think that you'd never feel happiness?
Yeah.
Like the
I
same
felt
sort
this
of way?
Darkness and sadness would be with me wherever I went, and yeah, people would look at me funny, and people still do. If I ever mention that I'm a widow, they're like, what? You know, even now I'm 38 and it's, you know, bizarre to people that you're widowed. And I'm like, yeah, you know, I lost my husband when I was 30 and I'm now 38 and I have two kids now and I have a fiance. And they're like, oh my goodness. Like, but 2016, Michael and I had been with each other nearly 3 years. I think it was about 2.5 years at the time. So I had really, in the beginning, had said, I'm never ever going to be with anybody ever again. I'm never putting myself through this again. But, you know, as we all know, you can't help who you fall for. So I'd met him at a wedding in 2013. And
so you didn't want to fall in love because you didn't want to experience loss again.
And even now, I still get a what if, like what if lightning strikes twice? You know, I just can't. You can't sit and dwell on it because you wouldn't get up in the morning if you did. So yeah, I decided to write the post, and it was just to kind of let people know, just take your time, like take it day by day. Don't expect too much from a day, but get out of bed. Have your breakfast, you know, give yourself something to do, whether it's go for a walk or go and meet a friend for coffee or something. Go and do that day, and let that be the one thing you achieve that day. And then the next day, start again and do the same thing again. And I think it really helped me. I never had a duvet day, never let myself lie in bed for the day, because I knew once I got into that habit of leave me alone, I want to be on my own, I'm staying in bed, that I wouldn't get out of it. And it was kind of late 2012, it was a year and a bit after he passed away, that I hit a big wall. I went back to work and found it really hard leaving Lily, and I really, really struggled. So I started seeing a counsellor in 2012, and I saw her, Patricia McNabb, again, amazing. But she was just a huge part of my world until, I think, 2 years ago, when I finally felt amazing again, that I stopped going to her. But I mean, so much has happened since then. It's just ridiculous. Like,
and what it's there's something about going back to work, because, and it happened to me as well. Like, when you go back to work, you're like, how can I sit at this desk and do this do all these normal things when I'm not the same person? I'm so different. There's so much going on in my brain. I can't just sit here and do normal things like normal people.
Yeah,
because you just feel through what you've experienced so different.
Absolutely. I felt like a completely different human being, but it got really overwhelming. And I went through a really bad patch, about a month of just, I was sick. I had strep throat all the time, which wasn't helping. I just felt crap. So I'd been in and out of my doctor, and then finally found a counsellor that suited me. I'd been to a couple and just was like, no, it's not my thing. But then found Patricia, and we really clicked, and it just helped me turn the corner of, I'm being too hard on myself. These are all huge things. I'm back to work. My baby is going into creche, and like, I knew the people that were looking after her in the creche, thank goodness. But like, you know, she was still away from me. The panic of, we didn't really know what had happened to Jeff properly, so what if that thing happens to Lily and I'm not there when that happens as well, because I wasn't really there.
And these are the things that people don't realize that suffering with.
Yeah.
And it's things that people go, but sure, of course it won't happen to her, but you're like, that's all I think about.
Yeah. And even 8 years on, I will sit in this chair and I can promise you every day I will think at some point throughout the day, what if? What if I get a phone call from school to say that Lily has collapsed, that something has happened to her? You know, what if I get a phone call from Michael's work to say that something has happened to him? Dylan now, I have a son and he's amazing. But again, what if I get a phone call to my mum, my dad, anybody? I am now open to this new sense of panic of what if. And I don't dwell on it. And I do tend to snap myself out of it quite quickly, because you'd be a bag of, I don't know what, if you just let yourself worry about it constantly. But I'm a different person now. I expect, sadly, kind of expect the worst if something is you know, about to unfold. I'm like, oh God. And then I have to really check myself and go, Sinead, relax. Like, that's not going to happen. Like, stop. You need to relax.
And so your advice then to people is to go to counselling, because it just really helped you cope with, I suppose,
everything.
Restarting your life.
Yeah. And just processing things. So things that you think are the worst possible thoughts that you could think, your counsellor will help you process them and help you talk through those thoughts. And she made me feel so normal, like that everything that I was thinking going through was just normal, a normal part of the process that I needed to go through to get out the other side of. And I mean, I've come a long, long way since 20, even before Jeff had passed away. I suffered with panic attacks. After he died, they were uncontrollable. I used to get them all the time. My hands would go tingly and I just feel that my heart started to race. It was ridiculous. And it was just my daily life. Any little small thing and I'd feel completely uncomfortable and I'd start to panic. And now I couldn't tell you the last time I had one. Like, it's just the nicest feeling in the world. I'd say the most nervous I've felt in a long time is coming in here to do this.
And the truth is that time is a healer.
Absolutely.
And
it's the worst sentence to hear when you're in the middle of it all.
You're like, right.
Ever.
Yeah. You're like, I will never feel better.
Absolutely.
What was it like then when Dylan was born? The moment they handed Dylan to you and everything was
amazing.
So different.
So I ended up having an emergency C-section with him. He was 6 weeks early, so he was a little bit ahead of time. So they lifted him up over the cover and it was the way it was meant to feel. Like, oh my God, look at this baby. And Michael was sitting by my side and he was crying and we were laughing because we were fully convinced we were having a girl and it wasn't a girl. And it was just the way it was meant to be.
And what's Michael like?
He's amazing. Michael is South African, so he lived in the UK for years and he only moved over here in 2016. He's just amazing. I've never met a guy who is so accepting of a person. Like, he gets really annoyed at me when I get into my strops, but that's fine. I mean, that's a good thing. So somebody keeps me in check. He's just so accepting. And, you know, people say, oh God, you know, how does Michael feel about you sharing that picture of Jeff? Or how does Michael feel about this? And I'm like, you know what? I usually talk to him first. If there's something that I really want to share about Jeff, I'll say, do you mind if I post this? Like, you know, would this make you feel in any way uncomfortable? And he's like, no, it's fine. And every time he's been like, no, that's fine. Because it's a part of my life. It's a part of our life because Lily is obviously a part of our life. I wouldn't be the person I am today only for what happened to me. So it's, yeah, he's an incredible, incredible guy.
And you're getting married this summer.
We are. So we're getting married in Dingle in August and we're very, very much looking forward to it now at this stage. It's only a few weeks away. Just after Jeff's anniversary actually. So I kind of figured that week is always so sad for me and it's always the entire week I just feel so down and so sad. And the wedding now is literally a couple of days after the anniversary and I just felt, you know what, this will be okay, you're allowed to be sad for the anniversary because it is a sad day. But then you have your wedding anniversary to look forward to. So it's going to just snap me out of that, like, sadness. Life is good. I'm back to work. I took a good while off after having Dylan. I took redundancy from the bank and took a good few months off. But I'm back working for a company now called PAX Financial Planning, which is very, again, close to my heart with the whole life insurance. And, you know, Jeff and I didn't have any life insurance at the time. We were only trying to sort our bits and pieces out. It's a hugely passionate thing for me to just make sure that young couples it's a taboo subject, I get it, but yeah, it's kind of like you need to protect yourselves. I didn't, and I learned the hard way. Life is good again. Like, it's a weird feeling to, like, I have a house, which is amazing as well.
And you've allowed yourself to be happy again.
Absolutely.
It's like you have to give yourself permission. Almost.
It's kind of almost like that, yeah, that you have to go, right, you've got two choices here. You can you can stay in bed all day and you can become that person. And eventually people stop asking you to do things with them. People stop phoning and texting if you keep saying, no, I'm fine, I don't want to go. Or, you know, you've got to keep accepting help. You've got to keep accepting company. Like, I was surrounded by people all of the time.
And that's something that I noticed about your story, is that you always speak about the people that you are surrounded with.
Absolutely.
And I know that through my own illness, that it's so easy to just close yourself off and not let anyone in. But when you let people in, they will carry you through it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's hard to do because you have a certain amount of pride as well. You know, I can do this myself and I don't need anybody, but you do need people. Everybody needs people in their life. I just can't thank everybody. I mean, there's friends that some of them I don't speak to that often anymore. Some I still have in my life every single day. But I wouldn't be here for the support and the encouragement and the kind of, right, what are we doing today? Like, let's go for a walk. Or, I mean, even the day that I went into labour, I was down in Knockzinc Woods, climbing over fences, out and about, you know, fresh air, let's do things. It was always a plan to get up and do things. And it's so important in life just to, if you're going through any sort of rough patch or anything, like, number one, tell people. People don't know. Facebook and Instagram can be so unrealistic sometimes that you could come across as the happiest person in the world. People will look at that and go, oh, isn't it great? They're having a great time. And secretly, you could be having the worst day of your life. So I've kind of learned in my Instagram stories as well, just to be a bit more realistic. Like, I've had a crap day today. So now I'm down in Dunleary and I'm having a walk and I feel better. You know, it's snapping yourself out of the darkness and the sadness. And, you know, you're absolutely allowed to feel sad and to cry, which I do regularly. But it's kind of knowing when enough is enough and saying, right, you had your little cry, you've had your little day of being annoyed or your few hours, now it's time to get back on the saddle again, and, you know, tomorrow is a new day kind of thing. And there's been quite a few of them. I do quite regularly.
Sinead, you're an absolute inspiration. I think you're amazing. You're so strong. And you were there for me when I got sick. You know, you can just tell that you've been through something because you just reached out to me. You didn't know me.
No,
you know?
I knew Jamie. But
you knew Jamie. So, like, thank you so much. And thank you so much for sharing your story on The Good Glow.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to The Good Glow podcast, made possible by Sally Hansen. To discover more, you can shop the products in Macaulay Health and Beauty Pharmacies and other stores across the country now. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please subscribe so you can be the first to hear about new ones. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please leave a review. To all my listeners in Ireland and those of you around the world, thank you for the amazing support and continued feedback. You can find out more about my story on thegoodglow.ie and follow me on Instagram at Georgie.Crawford.